loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we're going to take an examination of America's permanent war complex with investigative journalist and author Gareth Porter. And then we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a federal judge in California has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from denying asylum claims made outside of legal checkpoints, dealing a setback to the president's efforts to halt thousands of migrants making their way from Central America to the U.S. border. Next, Airbnb announced yesterday that it would withdraw all listings for homes in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, saying that those settlements were at the core of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel's tourism minister said he would sue the company immediately. Also yesterday, an Israeli sniper shot an AP cameraman with a press jacket on. Then the White House yesterday reinstated the press credentials of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta, but not until drafting new rules, saying that any reporter who asks a follow-up question without permission could then lose his or her press credentials. CNN has dropped its lawsuit against Trump. Meanwhile, the White House Correspondents Association, apparently bowing to Trump, announced that it would not have a comedian at its annual dinner this year, but instead will have a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian speak. Last year's speaker, comedian Michelle Wolf, called the association today a bunch of cowards. And then the Trump administration is preparing to add Venezuela to the list of state sponsors of terrorism in what would be a dramatic escalation of the conflict between the two countries. The list of state sponsors of terrorism is for countries, quote, that repeatedly provide support for acts of international terrorism, unquote, and it currently includes only Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. And finally, President Trump yesterday picked a Twitter fight with Pakistan over what he called that country's refusal to do anything to help the United States. Pakistan summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest, and Prime Minister Imran Khan took to Twitter to rebut Trump's allegations. And in other headlines, after weeks of saying otherwise, President Trump put out a statement today saying that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, quote, could very well have known, unquote, about the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He later added, however, quote, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, unquote. At least 50 people were killed and 72 wounded in Kabul, Afghanistan, during a religious celebration of the Prophet Muhammad's birthday. This is one of the deadliest attacks this year, even in the midst of recent violence in Afghanistan and specifically in Kabul. The attacker was a suicide bomber who blew himself up in the celebration hall, which held about 1,000 people at the time. Republican Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith is under fire for a recently unearthed photo she posted on Facebook in 2014, where she is wearing a Confederate Army hat and holding a Civil War-era rifle. The photos were taken during a Hyde-Smith visit to the Jefferson Davis Home and Presidential Library, which she referred to as, quote, Mississippi history at its best, unquote. Hyde-Smith was already facing criticism for her comments on public hangings and voter suppression. Norwegian law enforcement has charged a man in his 20s with sexual abuse charges, including rape, of about 300 teenage boys between the ages of 13 and 16. The abuse took place mostly over the internet, with the alleged rapist filming the boys doing sexual acts. The abuse started in 2001 in Norway and in other Nordic countries. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the U.S. military-industrial complex. Almost 58 years ago, President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned the country of a growing military-industrial complex. He said, quote, in the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist, close quote. All these years later, this prediction has, of course, come true. In a new article in the American conservative magazine, Gareth Porter argues that the United States has indeed transitioned into a permanent war complex where wars are now not meant to be temporary. Gareth Porter joins us in the studio. He is a historian, an investigative journalist, a political analyst, specializing in U.S. national security policy. He's also a prolific author whose most recent piece we're talking about today is called America's Permanent War Complex. Gareth Porter, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be back on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining. Yeah, I mean, we talk about the military-industrial complex all the time. You know, that's the thing about cliches. After a certain while, they lose meaning. They certainly lose the emotive context that makes them originally so powerful as formulations or phrases. But you are now saying what we really have is not just a military-industrial complex, but a permanent war complex. What do you mean?
Well, by that, I actually mean that what was a complex of private and public interests surrounding the Pentagon and the military contractors, which was for the purpose of keeping the money flowing into the Pentagon during the Cold War, but not particularly to maintain a state of war at all, has now become a system that is really addicted to or depends on the continuation of the set of wars that were started after 9/11, essentially. They're not the big wars. They're not the wars against major foes of the United States. Quite the opposite. They are smaller wars that can be continued indefinitely, and that has become the whole point of the set of wars, to keep them going. It's not the only thing the Pentagon does, but it has obviously become a huge part of it. And what I've argued here is that we have a process historically in which this complex that was for essentially a kind of permanent peace that could be turned into a short war like Vietnam has now become a system that is based on the idea of continuing these smaller wars indefinitely. And it really is a process that was marked by privatization. And I'm arguing here in my piece that it was indeed the rise of the military contractors that has set the stage for this, what I call the permanent war complex.
Yeah, I think the privatization element, when people read this article, it's an article by our guest, Gareth Porter. It's called America's Permanent War Complex. You can find it at the website of the American Conservative. It's an extremely important article. It's a substantial article. Take the time to read it. Take the time to reread it. If you're in one of those many anti-war or progressive study groups, take this document and study it together because it's not about something that happened a long time ago. It's writing about history as history is unfolding and unfolding in front of us with new dynamics. And the privatization thing is so important because private companies, Gareth, you're making the argument private companies are not simply selling weapons. They're not simply making money from selling weapons to the Pentagon. They're actually part of the war-making process, including you spent a substantial part of this article on what's going on, say, with the drone bombers and the drone pilots, many of whom, in fact, are private contractors.
Exactly. I mean, the drone wars are now of the essence of the permanent war complex because virtually all of the wars, perhaps not all of them, but the key ones, the ones that have attracted the most U.S. political attention and the ones that have caused the most casualties are wars that involve the dropping of or the firing of weapons by drones. And so it has been the companies that have been involved in producing the drones, and particularly a relatively unknown military contractor called General Atomics, that have risen to the top of the heap in terms of these wars. And what I show in my piece is that General Atomics, along with some other major military contractors, were indeed pulled into the actual fighting of the wars by the fact that the Pentagon and the armed services needed them in order to be able to carry out all the military functions that were involved in these wars, specifically around the drones, because A drone does not simply require somebody to push a button or to fly the drone. It involves a whole big team of specialists, including a lot of people who are required to analyze the images that are transmitted through this military system and to suggest when they think they have a target that is worth dropping a bomb on. And that meant that there was a requirement that the military itself could not meet with its own personnel, so they had to count on contractors to provide people, specialists, who could fill in all these specialized roles. And so that changed the basic nature of these drone wars from a war that was fought simply by the military to a war that was fought by the military and private sector contractors. And indeed, one could argue that the contractors had taken over the primary roles in those wars. And ultimately, you get to the point where, for example, in Afghanistan, as I point out in my article, by 2016, that war could no longer be fought without the drones. They became the primary factor in dropping bombs. For example, in Helmand Province, 61% of the bombs that were being dropped were from the drones by 2016. And that meant that, indeed, the drone contractors had become absolutely necessary to continuing this major U.S. war in Afghanistan. So that is really a key part of the storyline, that the contractors have become necessary to the continuation of the permanent war that we have going in Afghanistan, as well as the smaller drone wars elsewhere in the Middle East, in the greater Middle East.
You know, I think that's the future, Gareth. We see it in intelligence, too. We really have since just after the September 11th attacks, where in any given operation, in any given scenario, virtually anywhere in the world, you probably have a 70-30 breakdown between contractors and intelligence community employees, where just about everything is being outsourced to contractors. And then at the same time, it's making a lot of people very, very wealthy.
Well, I'm glad you've raised that, John, because what I try to document in my piece is this part of the history of the complex that involves the privatization of both the Pentagon and the intelligence community, where because of a deliberate policy of privatization, the private companies began to move in to both the CIA, the NSA, and the Pentagon, and to provide the specialists, the people who filled not just peripheral roles, but actual, you know, fundamental policy relevant roles throughout the military and intelligence communities. And indeed, it was happening so far and so fast, that Robert M. Gates, then Secretary of Defense, told Washington Post reporters around 2010 that he could not tell them how many of the contractors actually worked in the office of the Secretary of Defense. That means the entire Pentagon, the part of the Pentagon that is civilian as opposed to military. So that was an indication of just how far and how fast that process had gone.
Gareth Porter is our guest. We're talking about the permanent war machine, the permanent war complex. A major article he's written for the American Conservative. The article is entitled America's Permanent War Complex: Eisenhower's Worst Nightmare Has Come True, as defense mega contractors climb into the cockpit to ensure we stay overextended. As we were talking, Gareth, I went back to my Facebook page because Matthew Ho, the State Department official who out of principle resigned because of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, one of the rare American U.S. government officials who does something out of principle, like resign. He posted this thing, which was a chart showing how many bombs the U.S. is dropping in Afghanistan compared to like 3 years ago. It's about five times as many bombs
now.
So what you're saying is, like, at least in Helmand Province, 61% of those bombs are being dropped by drones. That means there's a private contractor, maybe right here in the Washington, D.C. area, not far from where we are in downtown, along with another team of people. They're operating a drone. They're the so-called pilot. They're collecting video. They're talking with themselves and others. They're assessing Should we kill these people?
That's right. Yep.
Should we kill these people? And then they decide to kill them, and they drop bombs. Now 5,000 plus bombs on Afghanistan this year alone. And then, you know, what? They go home and have a beer, I guess.
Well, that's about right. And of course, the point that you're making is extremely important in the sense that this does involve fundamental principle. And indeed, there was a major debate within the Pentagon among the military legal specialists about whether those contractors who were involved in what they call the kill chain in these wars, particularly in Afghanistan, of course, were in fact liable legally for the consequences of the bombs that are dropped. And there were cases, indeed, we know, where the contractors were involved in mistakes, where mass civilian casualties were the result. And that was a very important question that was being debated. Now, all this is leading, I think, to a final question that we haven't discussed yet, which is there a way to end the permanent war? And has the role of the contractor, the key role of the contractor and their congressional connections made it very much more difficult, if not impossible, to end these wars under the present sort of political system? And I go into that question in a lot of detail and point out that the problem has been that the drone contractors, particularly General Atomics and Northrop, which was the producer of something called the Global Hawk, which was not involved in dropping bombs but in intelligence, have spent so much money on lobbying Congress and providing, of course, the usual money to the campaigns of key members of Congress, that they have been able to keep the money flowing for the contracts for their drone projects, even when the Pentagon officials, the highest Pentagon officials, believe that it's no longer necessary or desirable to spend the money. And particularly, I'm talking here about the Global Hawk, which was a project that the Pentagon, senior Pentagon officials had decided it was not worth continuing the funding for. But Congress, the people in Congress who were getting the money from the contractors, said no, they wouldn't allow them to go along with that. So the Global Hawk continued to be funded, even though the Pentagon had decided it wasn't worth it. Now, the same thing could happen on the MQ-9 Reaper, which is the main plane that has been used for the dropping of bombs in Afghanistan by drones and elsewhere. And so that's really the nightmare that I think we face, that because of the hold that these contractors for the drone projects have on Congress, they could push very hard for the continuation of the production and the use of these drones, even though the case for it has been, it's been regarded as no longer useful, even by the brass in the Pentagon.
I just, outside of ethics or outside of policy, outside of morality, let's just talk about legality. Does the government or does any entity have the right to hire people to kill other people? I mean, in other words, private civilians, in this case, contractors. Is it legal? Is it legal that the government can say, we're going to hire drone pilots who are part of the kill chain, and they get to decide who lives and who dies? I mean, is that legal?
Well, I mean, it depends on exactly what you mean by is that legal. But as I said, there was a very strong case being made in the Pentagon by the military's own lawyers that this was a dangerous precedent to set.
Exactly. I'm asking you the question, but I actually firmly believe that if any other entity in society arrogated to itself the right to hire people to operate civilians who have no, you know, they've taken no oath or anything like that to be able to go around and kill people.
And give them immunity at the same time.
And give them immunity.
Well, they wouldn't have immunity. That's the argument that was being made. You do not have immunity.
No, you don't. You have no
exactly.
legal immunity.
Right, right.
But de facto, I mean, we've never seen a prosecution.
Right.
You know, there are a number of drone pilots who are actually sick and tired of being drone pilots.
Oh, and there are some prominent drone whistleblowers.
And they're linking up with other anti-war veterans mm-hmm. and anti-war veterans organizations and coming out and saying, no, they did this. They did this for a while. It was their job. But can you imagine actually deciding every day you're looking at grainy video feeds and, oh, am I going to drop the bomb or not drop the bomb? Then you don't know, is that grainy image, is that a child? Is that the grandmother of a child? Is that a wedding party, not a meeting of Taliban or ISIS
right.
people?
I spoke recently with a drone operator, a former drone operator, who told me a terrible story that he was looking at his screen following a target and his superior. He was in Nevada or New Mexico or something like that. His superior was at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, and they're both looking at their screens, and his supervisor told him, fire. And he said, I can't fire. There's a child there. And he was told, it's not a child. It's a goat. I'm telling you to fire. And he said, it's a child. I'm sure of it. I'm ordering you to fire. And he said he just couldn't do it. It was clearly a child. But there's no accountability. There's no one to say this is wrong. This is morally, legally, ethically wrong. And then we just dig ourselves a hole that's deeper and deeper and deeper.
And I just want to point out, there's another issue apart from the legal moral questions that you've quite correctly been raising, and that is the policy question of whether the drone war is in the political and military interests of the United States.
Sure.
And I point out in my article that several of the major policy makers or people who carried out policy of the United States militarily in the Middle East, including McChrystal himself, have pointed out that it's very clear to them that the drone war is not helpful. It's harmful to American interests because it makes more enemies than it eliminates.
It does.
That has been shown over and over again.
Since 2002.
Exactly. And that raises the question, why is this continuing when they know it not only doesn't work, but it is against the interests of the United States? And again, I think that you have to look at this in terms of the bureaucratic and economic interests that are combined here in this new, what I call the permanent war complex.
I think we're witnessing something in a big historical sense that's a closing of the circle for modern day capitalism, going back to its roots. Modern day, the beginnings of capitalism, the genesis of capitalism, you had private corporations who were actually the entities going to war. Look at the Dutch East Indies Company or the English East Indies Company. Now, the English East Indies Company in 1602 had 100,000 soldiers and sailors, much bigger than the British Navy. They wouldn't listen to when King James told them don't go to war against Portugal because Britain wanted to make an alliance with Portugal. The British East Indies Company went out and sunk all the ships in the Portuguese Navy anyway. Finally, you had the Indian Revolt of 1857, which basically changed the constellation of forces such that the British government said, look, your private companies are such provocateurs and acting so recklessly, it's hurting the interests of the British Empire. And that's when private companies were reduced to relegated to a backroom role. Now we have modern day capitalism and imperialism, the same sort of global interests. For markets and domination. And you have this merger of private war-making corporations with the state apparatus, but again, without anybody ever having debated this issue or not really debated it.
It's a very good point. And in fact, I quote from the book by the two Washington Post reporters published, I think, in 2010 or 2011, quoting a senior military official who had served in Afghanistan, who told them that, and this is almost a direct quote, it hits you like a ton of bricks when you think about it. The Pentagon is no longer a war fighting machine. It's a business.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why you have somebody like Eric Prince directly asking the President of the United States to outsource the war in Afghanistan to him and to his company because it's a business.
Right.
That's it.
Again, Gareth Porter is our guest. Gareth has written a major article. It's a very well-researched article and a substantial article. It's called America's Permanent War Complex. You can see it at the website of the American Conservative. That's theamericanconservative.com. I generally don't favor anything that's conservative, Gareth, but I do commend them for having your article, which I think really helps open people's eyes about a phenomena. Yes, we had Dwight D. Eisenhower more than 50 years ago saying, it's a military-industrial complex. It will be a dagger pointed at the heart of democracy. In his draft, he called it the military-industrial-congressional complex. And then some of his aides said, don't anger Congress by including them in this complex. And then he took it out. But it is a military-industrial-congressional complex. And it's got a few other pillars to the complex.
And I'm ready to argue now that the congressional part of that complex is in many ways the single most dangerous part of it. It's the part of it that could be, or I would argue, actually is the primary obstacle to calling a halt to these wars that really nobody believes in anymore.
And the other thing about it, and I think I want to just say this because I just saw yesterday, and of course I should have seen it before, Elliot Engels, the Democrat, will now become chairperson of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Well, one of his first acts when he came into Congress was to introduce a resolution to have the United States recognize Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel. He was a cheerleader for Bush's invasion of Iraq. He was all about the breakup of Yugoslavia and the Yugoslav wars in the mid and late 1990s. You think about all these progressive and liberal people who have been hoping for the blue wave. Now the House is back under the control of the Democrats. So you have this guy, Engels, and he's not unusual. It's the same war machine. It is the military-industrial congressional complex, and it's Republican and it's Democrat.
Yeah, and even the young Democrats who ran on a platform of change, I think now understand at some level that this is the case, and they are no longer buying into it. It appears. We hope so, anyway.
Yeah, where does this all go? Because, Gareth, we now have the United States reorienting the national security strategy, not towards these smaller wars where drones are sufficient. It's towards major power conflict now with Russia and China, which doesn't mean the smaller wars are going to stop. But it also demonstrates that there's actually no congressional accountability, just congressional spending and acquiescence to this complex. Where does it go? 1 minute left.
Well, I think we're going to have this struggle really between two sets of interests in the Pentagon, one of which is primarily devoted to continuing the permanent wars, the other set of interests primarily devoted to shifting more and more resources away from the wars to preparation for war with Russia and China, although they are not interested in having those wars, I guarantee you that.
Right. When the major powers can't fight each other, though, they usually resort to proxy wars. And we see evidence of that. Either way, both sides, it's war. Yeah. It's a warfare state. We don't live in a welfare state. We live in a warfare state. Welfare for warfare.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We were joined by Gareth Porter. He joined us in the studio here in Washington, D.C. Gareth is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He's also a prolific author whose most recent piece we're talking about today is called America's Permanent War Complex. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined, as we are every Tuesday, from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, these are rocky times on the stock market. Of course, for working people, it hasn't been anything other than a rocky time for a long time. We want to talk about that. But since we're talking to you from Northern California, are you able to breathe?
Well, yeah. Fortunately, the office where I work at, they have good filtration. But I'll tell you, a lot of people are not comfortable at all. And definitely face masks are all over the place when you go out in public.
You can tell. When you're outside, you can tell the difference in air quality.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I start getting a runny nose and congestion and all that as if I kind of had a cold. So, yeah, it's absolutely noticeable. I mean, until recently it was the worst air quality in the world in some spots in California. So, I mean, it beat, you know, Beijing and all these places that historically have really bad air quality. So it's been pretty brutal.
We're going to talk about the long-term human health impact of these wildfires. But of course, Daniel, they also will have a profound economic impact, not just on California, but elsewhere. And especially if they become something other than an anomaly, something that's perhaps common, something typical, as awful as that seems, there's a lot of indications that that may be exactly where we're headed.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I mean, Paradise, California was not a tiny town. It was, I believe, 32,000 people live there, and it's essentially been wiped out. It doesn't exist anymore. We all know the housing crisis in California is some of the worst in the United States. A recent bill to try to put protections in place, or at least allow rent control protections in place, was defeated recently, meaning that our rent control protections remain as poor as they were before. And now we suddenly, all these people are effectively homeless, you know, overnight. Even those who were lucky enough to get insurance, of which there are some, will still have to rebuild, and there'll be all kinds of costs factored in, and much of their property will be destroyed. And while they're lucky to have insurance, they're still going to take a tremendous loss. This will also further aggravate the housing crisis. I mean, you know, overnight, these people I think that many of them are staying in a Walmart parking lot, if I'm not mistaken, in a camp, essentially. As this stuff becomes more common, people aren't going to want to build in that area, right? Developers aren't going to want to put up new homes there because it'll probably get burned down. The insurance costs will be either very high, or insurance companies just outright will refuse to support it. Then infrastructure won't get rebuilt, like, you know, power lines, water mains, et cetera. And you'll essentially see these become kind of ghost towns. There'll be this increase in the desertification of California, where regions will become more like deserts and less like, you know, kind of grasslands and forests that they were before. So it has severe economic impacts. It's going to cause housing prices to skyrocket even more as the supply gets even more restricted due to these out-of-control fires. So, yeah, there's going to be tremendous cost to these.
As someone from Northern California, not from Paradise yourself, but do you think that people were listening to Donald Trump's sagacious advice that they should rake more?
Yeah, it's. I think he called Paradise something else.
Pleasure.
That's right. He called it Pleasure California, which is, you know, this just disgusting contempt. And, you know, that's I'd say it's an accident and him just being an idiot, which is certainly possible. But I don't know. He started making all those comments in the midst of people losing everything to a raging wildfire, including some losing their lives, that, you know, oh, it's our forest mismanagement problem, as if, you know, if we managed our forest differently, we wouldn't have climate change, which is, of course, insane. And just, you know, the total disrespect for. He knows which way California swings, and it would take an act of God for it to swing towards the GOP. So why not, you know, insult and mock the people who have lost everything, some of them who have lost their lives, have lost family members? Why not forget the name of the town that they're in and come there and mock them? You know, that's the point of his presidency. You know, they wanted a culture war, and he'll bring them a culture war, and he'll laugh at, you know, the misfortunes of these so-called blue liberal states, you know, who are now suffering, you know, these tremendous catastrophic consequences. You notice, of course, you know, that language didn't come out of Houston when Houston was effectively drowned recently. You know, then it's Houston strong and support Houston. And if it's Puerto Rico, he's just going to ignore them and throw paper rolls at them. So it's very intentional.
Yeah. Daniel Sankey is our guest. We're talking to him about the big issues in the economy. But because we're talking to Daniel from Northern California, the epicenter of these terrible wildfires that continue, we're talking to him first about what's going on right then and there. And John, you know, I was talking to Walter Smolarek, who lives, he's our producer, but he lives in Philadelphia.
Yep.
The skies are filled with smoke in Philadelphia from the fires that are up.
Walter showed me a map that the National Weather Service has put out showing how the smoke from the fires in Northern California sort of swoops down to Texas and then back up through the deep south into Virginia and then up all the way to Philadelphia. And, you know, it goes right over Virginia and Maryland and Washington, D.C. And I can tell you that it's very hazy today, and it's not because it's cloudy.
Yeah, it's just a reminder that everything is interconnected. We are interconnected as people. Society connects us, but also the environment connects us. Daniel, one final word on that, and then let's turn to the big economic stories, and there's a number of them. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think connectivity is really the name of the game. We're not, it's not about blue or red or south versus north. It's about the fact that we are all dependent on one another, and we're going to either survive this together or we're going to perish together. But the important thing is we can't just isolate from one another. That doesn't happen when it comes to an ecological crisis like we have now.
Okay, that said, now let's talk about that which divides us, because because we're divided also based on, some are small number, are rich, some are kind of rich, many are comfortable, then a whole lot of people are not comfortable at all. We've been in an economic expansion since 2008 or so, or 2009. It's perhaps the second longest economic expansion ever following a recession. It was a very, very, very slow expansion in the beginning. I mean, many millions, I would say tens of millions of workers didn't notice at all. They were still either unemployed or working in an underemployed capacity, lower wages. But the economy has been picking up in the last couple of years. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal today. Is the U.S. ready for the next recession?
And you know it's coming because it's cyclical.
It's cyclical. Is the United States ready? It seems like there's a lot of signs right now, Daniel Sankey, that in fact, we are heading towards a major economic recession, a contraction.
Yeah, it's definitely about time. It's been a decade since the last one, almost to the month, if I remember, in October of 2008 is when it all started to go down, and now we're into November. We're certainly due for it based on the cyclical nature of these things. You know, what's interesting, though, is to discuss, are we ready for it? Because the question isn't when will it happen, but when will it happen? And we can speculate on that all we want. But it will happen, and probably soon. And what can we do about it, and are we prepared for it? And I think there's some really important things that we need to take away from it. Since 2008, in many ways, the federal government was able to kind of save the economy and bail out the banks by taking some pretty dramatic measures. And really, the measures amounted to giving huge loans out to financial institutions mostly to stimulate the economy. And so back in 2008, before the crash, about 36% or so of productivity, of profit and output was related to debt, right? Was related to debt mostly from the Fed. And then when we entered the crisis, it shot way up. It skyrocketed to about 77%. And it's getting closer to more 78-80% now, or at least it's predicted to do that in 2020. So what that means is the amount of debt has effectively doubled, or maybe even more than doubled, than we had before. Now, we could suddenly take on all this debt because we can go from 35% to 77%. You know, we have some wiggle room there. But now the amount of debt we have is so significant that bailouts like that we're starting to run out of money for, and we're starting to not be able to bail out in quite the same way without some serious financial consequences. And I don't just mean cutting some budgets or reducing food stamps. I mean eliminating whole programs that would, you know, alter the kind of face of American life. Additionally, we had really high interest rates back then for the Fed at 5.25%, which gave them a lot of wiggle room. They could lower those interest rates down and make money cheaper. And help, you know, kind of stimulate the government, which they did. But right now, our rates are a little over 2%. So it's less than half of what they were before, which means we have that much less wiggle room. Because back then, we dropped the 5.25% down to zero. So what that means really is, back in 2008, we did all these financial machinations to bail out the economy, to keep it afloat and to preserve it. And we had wiggle room and money to do it. Now, those options are not nearly as attractive as they were before or nearly as possible. We're a lot less ready for it. I like to compare what we did in 2008 to steroids, where, you know, you inject all this money and you seem really strong and really healthy for a brief period of time. You kind of run with it and you're saved. But there's all these long-term health consequences. And really, it's not real strength or real fitness. It's artificially produced by this, you know, chemical. In a lot of ways, that's what we're seeing now, is the cracks are starting to happen. And many investors are becoming more and more aware of this debt-fueled bubble that we pushed for the last decade since the last bailout, and are starting to realize there's no real value there. You know, there's just debt there and the pumping up of prices based on this debt. And they're starting to get spooked and starting to pull out money, which is why we've seen so much volatility and so many downturns over the last few weeks.
Let's talk about what's going on the stock market. It seems like it's been four technology companies that have led the way. Not only them, it's also banks and oil companies. But you have, of course, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. I was looking at some of those valuations today. Apple has lost, in the last couple of months, 20% of its value. It was valued, remember we did stories about this value.
Yep.
Amazon's value reaches $1.1 trillion, a trillion-dollar valuation. That was like 2 or 3 months ago. It's now $828 billion, about a 20% loss. Amazon, big, big losses. Google, big losses, all of them. And Facebook, actually, I think about a 40% loss of the value of a Facebook stock in the last period. If these companies, which were the ones that everyone was betting on, and this is actually, let's just face it, a casino. You bet on the horses that you think are stronger horses, the ones that are favorite to win. You might get a lesser return, but they're going to win because they're huge. They're mega monopolies. But right now, Daniel, they're the ones that are contracting.
Yeah, exactly. They have been at the top of the economy and driving all this. The tech sector has really been the source of all profitability and economic growth lately. And especially, you know, we see this chaos at Facebook, which has been published in the New York Times, which has been discussed in other segments, which is, of course, you know, really harming their market share. Then Apple, you know, is reaching capacity in terms of the market is being saturated with iPhones, and they're not getting the same sort of growth that they did before, which is to be expected, right? Back when they first started, no one had iPhones, and there was, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of people to sell iPhones to, maybe even billions. And now we're reaching capacity. Now they have some facial recognition technology, which is probably not as attractive as it once was, given how common knowledge privacy concerns are in our day-to-day, where people are saying, geez, they can recognize my face and record it. I don't know. I don't think it's as attractive as a feature as they thought it would be. And in a lot of ways, what, you know, the iPhone 8 does is what the iPhone 10 does. It's not dramatically different. And so they're really saturating this market and trying to sell these $1,000 a pop phones, and the people aren't buying. And so Apple is starting to downturn. Then we see, of course, Amazon is downturning. If these are the darlings, if these are the economic powerhouses that are supposed to churn out value at the top of our economy, and they aren't, that's going to cause investors to start losing a lot of faith, not just in tech stocks, but in the economy in general. Boy, if we overvalued those, what else are we overvaluing, and what else do we need to pull out of?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. And people aren't thinking about it, even investors.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are some very kind of highly paid big whales out there in the investment world that are starting to think more and more about it. And that's why we're seeing all this volatility. So, you know, what does it mean? It means we're reaching overcapacity. It means we're saturating the market, which is a classic. Almost every crisis in capitalism occurs where you create a new market, you sell as much as you possibly can, and then you produce too much because everybody has what you're offering. So, you know, even Facebook talked about launching satellites in countries or over countries that don't have the internet so that those countries could get the internet so they could sign up for Facebook. Then you have Apple struggling to move iPhones. The point is we're reaching that peak. We've saturated that market. We've had that major transformation from a society where the iPhone didn't exist to a society where almost everybody has an iPhone or at least a smartphone. And then we're seeing this downturn. And that's what happens. But of course, these companies have to keep producing because profit is the name of the game. They keep having to sell even more than they sold before, even bigger margins than they had before. And because that's the drive, they're going to overproduce. And that's what we're seeing now. So in other words, we have a whole bunch of iPhones that we can't sell. We have a whole bunch of Facebook signups that we can't get because everybody's on our Facebook, et cetera. And we're starting to see that downturn.
People don't fully grasp this part of capitalism. And I want to spend a moment to try to understand it. The thing that makes capitalism so dynamic is the competition for a limited market. So in order to beat out your competitor, you have to make a product that's either cheaper or better. And so you do certain things that reduce labor costs constantly. You use machine labor over human labor. You constantly revolutionize the technology to produce goods cheaper. And you keep producing and producing and producing in competition with other producers. And at a certain point, that limited market gluts. That limited market reaches a point of saturation. And then the same dynamic competitive feature that makes capitalism so, well, all the apologists for capitalism would say so great, are the thing that brings the entire production process to a halt because things are being produced blindly, meaning you don't know fully what the market will take, you're rushing and racing against your competition, and ultimately you produce too much. And that's when you have the problem or the main crisis of capitalism, which is the crisis of overproduction. The system starts to break down. It starts to fail. It starts not to work, not because of a shortage of goods, but a surplus of goods, meaning more has been produced than can be sold at a profit. Not necessarily more than can be used by human beings, but can be used by human beings after purchasing them in a way that the producer, the capitalist, gets enough back so that they can have a profit. That's what we're looking at. And just to break it down, what Daniel's saying, I'm looking again at the Wall Street Journal, not a socialist newspaper. Here's the headline. Lower iPhone demand bites Apple suppliers. Lower than expected demand for Apple Inc.'s new iPhones and the company's decision to offer more models have created turmoil along its supply chain and made it harder for Apple to predict the number of components and phones it needs. People familiar with the situation said. In recent weeks, Apple slashed production orders for all three of the iPhone models it unveiled in September. These people said, frustrating executives at Apple suppliers, as well as workers who assemble the phones and their components. So what we have is suppliers. These are the subcontractors who actually make Apple phones, meaning not only businesses, but the workers who work in these businesses. And they're in China. They're all over the world. Now they don't know what to expect in terms of what Apple will actually purchase. So they have to stop producing as much. They have to stop production lines. They have to lay off workers. And then you have the problem of overproduction, and consequently, overproduction leads to its opposite. Instead of overproduction, we then have shortages, and especially the shortages of jobs. And then when people don't have jobs, they don't have an income, they can't buy other products, and thus overproduction ripples through the economy into a generalized recession or a depression. This is a law of capitalism. Again, the same competitive dynamic that makes capitalism so profoundly dynamic. I mean, the thing that brings new products constantly into the market is the thing that is its soft underbelly.
Yeah, it's really important to understand that dynamic because it's really brand new in the history of human beings. That is to say, until very recently, if you told a community, say in the feudal times or even several hundred years ago, that we're having an economic crisis because we have too much, they would have looked at you like you're crazy. Because in history, economic crises occurred because of not enough. You know, there was a flood or a famine or something like that, and people starved, people died, and that was an economic crisis, a lack of commodities, a lack of what they needed. Nowadays, the problem is that we have too much, or that we have too much that we can sell for a profit. Because we are not producing iPhones for people to use and enjoy. We're producing iPhones for people to buy. In fact, you know, that's a big part of planned obsolescence, which a lot of technology companies do. That is to say, their technology is intended to go out of date quickly, intended to break or become non-functional rapidly, forcing people to have to buy something new. I mean, everybody knows it's kind of proverbial, oh, my computer is 2 years old, which means it's a dinosaur. It's, you know, ancient. That's intentional because they'd much rather you buy a new computer every 2 years than every 10 years or something like that. And that is the point of what they're producing. They're not producing a computer for you to use and enjoy and gain information and help you in various tasks. They're producing it for you to buy. If everybody burned their iPhone right now and then had to go back and buy a new one, you'd see this tremendous growth and explosion in Apple. So that's the point. This technology is being created for purposes of sale, not purposes of enriching people's lives. And so consequently, we have too much, and too much is a problem. Too much means loss of jobs, loss of income, and all the resultant things. Also, you know, Apple is a giant. It's a monopoly. So it reaches into so many different sectors and so many different industries that it's not just like Apple employees that are impacted or Apple investors. It's all these other little companies that actually build iPhones, that actually produce the materials that go into iPhones, that are impacted as well. And they are global. They aren't just in the US. And that impacts the global economy as a whole. So that's why, you know, it's such a big deal when people see Apple starting to bottom out and things starting to fall, because it's really not just one company that's impacted. It's this huge network of companies that come together to produce Apple products that are impacted by these this overproduction on Apple's end.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. We're talking about the big economic issues of the day, the possible onset of a recession. It will happen. We don't know when it will happen, but it will happen. Again, there's many, many troubling signs that the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and the financial section of the New York Times are paying attention to. Here's one a headline, Daniel Sankey. If GE, that's General Electric debt, gets junked, markets have reasons to shudder. Hopefully, GE will end up merely as a case study in financial mismanagement rather than the trigger for messy markets. Now, that's euphemistic. What they're talking about is General Electric is so big that if their stock gets rated as junk, meaning worthless, this could have a triggering impact on the entire rest of the economy.
Just like in the 70s when General Motors went on strike and it pushed the entire economy into recession. We still have companies that are that big, that are that critical to the economy, that if things don't work out for them, even just over the course of a couple of quarters, it could trigger a recession. But that's the nature of capitalism.
Absolutely. I mean, so I think this connects back to what I said earlier about debt, because what they're talking about is downgrading GE's debt to junk, so that what GE does to raise money so it can operate when it has to spend more money than it earned is it sells bonds in GE, and that bonds is essentially debt bonds. And so investors give them money in exchange for these bonds, and the bonds are promised to yield a certain return. So that's sort of like GE paying back, you know, interest on these to investors. They usually do these bond sales because it's cheaper and easier than just taking a loan out from the bank. There's a lot more advantages to it. So most of the time, big companies like this do these bond sales. But essentially what they're doing is they're getting loans from investors is all it comes down to. Downgrading it to junk would basically say these bonds are kind of the most worthless, the lowest category of bonds, which is incredible given GE's size. But that's what we're seeing. This goes back to what I was talking about before about these companies pumping themselves up with debt and using that debt that they've accrued to artificially inflate their market size, artificially inflate their profitability and valuation, which is something GE has continued to do. And that's why its bonds are getting marked down as junk, because they weren't, you know, the funds weren't being used to expand into new markets or create new products. They were just using to pump up the price of the company. That's part of the financial mismanagement. So what we're seeing is this giant, this behemoth who can raise all this money, because wouldn't you invest in GE if you're an investor? I mean, it's kind of hard to articulate it, I think, to a younger generation, but GE has been like the Apple of the United States, but for decades, you know, this huge brand name everybody knew and was considered kind of almost synonymous with the United States, synonymous with America, with corporate America. And so naturally, investors felt like, oh, man, GE has its fingers in just about everything. Surely it's going to produce money. It's worth loaning them some money. But now it looks like actually it's kind of a mirage, that they got the brand name, but they aren't producing the same profits they used before, and that there are risks of default or risks in them not nearly paying out as much in those bonds as they thought. This goes to what John was saying, which is there are companies that are so big and influential in our economy that if they have a few bad quarters, they can actually push us into recession, which kind of leads us to ask, if GE's performance is so tied to the overall health of our society, the overall ability for it to produce wealth and meet people's needs, why is it privately owned? Why is it owned by just a tiny group of people who are not going to make decisions based on the vast majority of society's needs? They're going to make decisions based on very particular small groups' need for profit. And yet those decisions are not just going to impact those small groups' needs for profit. They're going to impact hundreds of millions of people throughout the United States. That leads me to question, is this the right way to own and govern this particular company or system that impacts so many things? Given its monopoly status, doesn't it make more sense to have it owned in a public way where its actions are accountable to the people it actually impacts, i.e. everybody else in the United States and potentially globally?
Talk about a small group of people making the big decisions and getting amply rewarded for it. The CEO of Nissan, the second largest car company in Japan, a company that employs 470,000 people in many, many countries on all continents, he's in jail today. What happened?
Yeah, so the CEO of Nissan, it's kind of hard to articulate what a big name he has been in corporate America for decades. again, I think a lot of listeners, especially younger ones, might not, you know, equate him, who has been just a huge public face in corporate America for a long time, and really kind of the dominant face of Nissan, the really central power of it. He was responsible for laying off huge amounts of people while consolidating this company with a number of other auto manufacturers as well back in the 80s and 90s. As he sort of consolidated power, he cut a tremendous amount of jobs and created a tremendous amount of profitability by making a lot of redundancies obsolete within these two companies. He has recently been outed, and what he's being accused of is essentially underreporting his income. So not paying his taxes, saying he made less money than he did, and underpaying his taxes, which is, you know, so common at this level, you know, it's laughable. It's certainly nothing particularly new. What I want to point out is, while everybody loves a good scandal, I think that this shows more that there are kind of machinations within Nissan that don't like his monopoly power over the company and want to use this as an excuse to sort of oust him and push him out. I think they were very aware of him underreporting things. This is not the first time he's done it. I promise you, he's been doing it for a long time. And so long as he made money and towed the line, people were happy to look the other way. Now, I think he's fallen afoul of other powerful influences within Nissan and the auto company in general. And they're using this as kind of a cynical opportunity to push him out. So while, you know, I enjoy the Schadenfreude as much as else of a wealthy tax evader getting what they deserve, let's not be too easily fooled by it. I'm sure the people that uncovered this had much less noble motivations to doing it than, you know, justice or getting tax money back to the state.
We have 45 seconds left. In the same vein, Aramco, in the midst of a Saudi royal family crisis, is also not going forward with its public offering. Behind all of these scandals, including ones where people have done outrageous things like killing the journalist who came into the consulate, there are internecine factional fights that are really driving the events forward. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell that Saudi has decided not to sell Aramco because they'd have to open the books and let the investors see how much money they had, where it is, and what they're doing with it. And they do not want to do it, which kind of makes me question, how much money do they really have? Because at this point, we're just taking their word for it that it's worth all these billions of dollars. Geopolitically, Saudi's current king is falling out with the United States. And this is just a part of that process of us trying to move him out and say, nah, we want another ruler. We don't like what you're doing. We've decided that the Khashoggi murders and whatnot are something we want to make a big deal out of. And this is really us trying to drive him out and install some sort of new leadership in the Saudi government.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.